11 a.m. So
So
everybody can
let's get
participate in the welcome. And
started.
let's get started. A pleasure to welcome back Shuly Mishkin, and for her next series on archaeology, this time on the Second Temple. And since I'm being unable to do her regular tours of Israel, so this is the next best thing. And it's a pleasure to welcome you back. And we look forward to the four week session on the Second Temple period. B'vakasha.
Okay, hi everybody. Good morning, good evening, depending on where you are. People who are new, I'm Shuly Mishkin. We have so much to do today, so I am going to get us already into screen sharing because we have a lot to accomplish. Second Temple times, okay? It's probably one of my favorite time periods in Jewish history because it is just a fascinating, dynamic time period where so much that has shaped the modern world, certainly in Judaism, but this is also the time of the emergence of Christianity, right? So, this is a time period where so much has changed, where we move from a community based only in the land of Israel to communities in the diaspora, right, that are all united but different, where we move from having a small temple, a small mikdash, to a very grand and imposing one that is then destroyed. And how do we live with that, right? So many transitions, so many changes, and so many important developments. So, what we're going to do over the next four sessions, we're going to spend two of them on Herod. It's not only about Herod, but about what he built, where he built, because he really does dominate certainly the physical landscape of the land of Israel. But we're going to see also the intellectual landscape as well when we talk about what he did here, both pro and con. Okay, so those are going to be our first two classes. We're going to spend a class on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I realize we could spend a semester on the Dead Sea Scrolls or a year, but we're going to do a class on it. And then we're going to finish up by talking about the Great Revolt, not in Jerusalem, which I think more people know about, but up north in Gamlan, in Yodfat. So without further ado, let's get started. So this is our first session on Herod. We want to look at where he comes from, who is he, what is his impact, like I said, on the landscape, on the economy. Next time, we're going to look at different places, but we're also going to look at Herod's impact on Judaism. Who are his supporters and who is against him? Right. So we have a lot of different things we want to discover. And today the sites we're going to focus on are Masada, as you can see in this fabulous picture of the Northern Palace, and Caesarea, two of the most imposing creations that Herod made. Next time we're going to talk about Jerusalem, don't worry, and Herodium, but right now we're going to stay with Masada. Even if we only talk in terms of building, Herod's impact on the land of Israel is unbelievable. He builds all of Jerusalem, right? The Jerusalem that we think of when we think of Second Temple Jerusalem is almost completely Herodian, as we're going to see next week. He builds the city of Caesarea. He builds fortresses, as we're going to see all over the country. He builds Ashkelon, and he builds in Akko, in Sebastia, in the Shomron. In Antipatris, near the coast. Okay? He even builds outside of the land of Israel. Okay? He builds in Beirut and in Sor and in Antiochia and in Rhodes. He has an impact, a global impact, or at least in our area. So really somebody who is so significant. Oh, I'll just remind people who don't know from last time, if you have questions, please, please, please put them in the chat and I will try to address all of them at the end. Okay. Take a quick look at a timeline. Just because this is our first class, let's understand just a little bit Second Temple timeline before we get to the Hasmoneans and Herod. Okay, Second Temple meaning First Temple is destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE, but the Jews return relatively quickly. Okay, they return already when the Persians conquer the Babylonians, and Cyrus the Great allows, along with others, the Jews are not the only ones, but he allows people to return to their homelands and to rebuild their temples. The Jews come back, albeit a very small percentage of Jews, right? Tovli b'Vavel, it's not so terrible there in Babylonia. Most people end up staying, but a small group does come back and rebuild, which is shocking in the ancient world, and starts from a very, very small beginning. Tiny, defenseless little community in Jerusalem, enemies all around, internal, external, building a very small temple and slowly building up to this incredibly grand temple in the time of Herod, with communities in the land of Israel, in the diaspora, Okay, that is probably the most important and significant change. Well, one of them, right? We also move from a community to more individual styles of worship and of Judaism. But this idea that we have diaspora communities and we have what Shaya Cohen calls unity within diversity, that you can be a Jew living in Rome, you can be a Jew living in Antiochia, you can be a Jew living in Babylonia or in Jerusalem. You dress differently, you speak differently, you eat different foods, and yet one can travel to the other and feel comfortable eating in his home, okay, praying in his synagogue. So this diversity with the unifying factor of all of us more or less following certain principles. So that's a very significant idea that only begins in Second Temple times and to a great extent continues to today. Okay, let's take a look at the more specific timeline that we have here. Okay, people who came to the class we did on Hanukkah, this should all be so familiar to you. Okay, middle of the second century before the Common Era, we have our story of Hanukkah. Judah the Maccabee defeats the Greeks. We get the beginning of Hasmonean sovereignty, 100 years where the Hasmoneans rule, right? The last real period of Jewish sovereignty until 1948, with a very short exception with Bar Kokhba in the second century of the Common Era. Okay, Yochanan Hyrcanus expands the Hasmonean kingdom and converts the Edomites. It's going to be very important for us in a couple of slides. Okay, after this 100-year period, the Hasmonean kingdom, which has become very Hellenized and also very divided, okay, there is a civil war between two brothers, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. The Romans come in to arbitrate, shall we say, and do not leave. Okay, in the wake of all of that, that's how Herod ultimately becomes the ruler. We'll come to that in a minute. Okay, important to understand because sometimes we have little boxes in our heads. This time period is the same time period that you learned about in high school when you read Julius Caesar. Okay, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, and Cleopatra, that's the time period we're talking about. So if that helps you to contextualize why Herod is so worried all the time that people are going to kill him, you know, even paranoid people have enemies. He really does have enemies, just like Julius Caesar did and just like Mark Antony did. All right, so that's the time period we're talking about. And Herod is interacting, by the way, with many of these people. Okay. In the year 40, Matityahu Antigonus conquers Jerusalem with the help of the Parthians, okay, the son of Aristobulus. Herod flees to Masada and then to Rome, where he gets appointed to be the king of the Jews. And his rule begins, he solidifies it in the year 37. Despite the instability, right? He begins his reign under the rule of Antony and Cleopatra. They are defeated 6 years later at the Battle of Actium. Herod sails to Rome immediately, prostrates himself in front of the new emperor, Octavian. I was loyal to Antony. I'll be twice as loyal to you. It works. His gambit works. And he keeps up with Roman support. And in between, he does all his building projects. In the year 4 before the Common Era, Herod dies and is buried in Herodium. By the way, there's a lot of confusion among Christians, right? You talk about Herod as the enemy who wants to kill all the babies, and that's why Jesus's parents have to run away to Egypt. That's not our Herod, if the story happened, right? If the story happened, Herod dies before Jesus is born. We're talking about Herod's son, Herod Antipas, but we're not going to go into the Christians right now. They will come up later. Have no fear. Okay. Herod expands. Okay. Take a look because this is nice to see. Okay. Herod expands his kingdom from the traditional, the Hasmoneans have expanded the kingdom as well, but Herod inherits a kingdom that includes Judea, Idumea, the other side of the Jordan, right? Perea over here, and the Galilee. Okay, these are the classic Jewish areas, even though it takes Yochanan Hyrcanus and Alexander Yanai to expand to there, but that's what Herod inherits. Okay, but then let's see if I could switch colors. I don't think I can. I'm not smart enough. You guys are smart enough to follow. Okay, Herod is able to.
Can I? Yeah. Do you mind? Can you make the picture slightly bigger? It's only taking up part of the screen. I think for some people, it might be a little difficult.
Hold on. Let me see if I can do that while we're in the Zoom.
If not, whatever. But I'm just saying, if you can, it would be good. If not, we'll manage.
I'm not sure if it will work while we're in the... No. Very bad.
Okay.
Very bad.
Okay. Whatever.
Sorry. Hopefully that will not create problems for us later. But I don't think I can do it while I'm in the Zoom. I'm sorry.
Just did.
The other ones were also as bad. were also as small?
Yeah, they're all sort of, I can see them, but I can see that it's a little bit hard to see. So I don't know if somebody, one of the younger people knows all the technology.
You know what? So give me a second. I'm going to stop share for a second.
Oh.
I'm going to go into my PowerPoint and try and open each one up.
It was better. Full size. It was full size. So I think what the issue is, the people who it looks small are probably having a bandwidth issue on their end. But it looked full. It filled the full screen on my screen.
Okay. That's
okay.
a good
okay.
thing to hear because
you know
I don't
what?
Really want to switch
somebody
all
pointing
of them.
Out? No, if you're in speaker view as
it's
opposed to gallery view,
it'll
be
full size. Bigger. It's full size.
All right. So let's
go
back.
I apologize for that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's go back to where we were. Slideshow. Yes, from our current slide. Okay, good. So we have, so Herod expands, right? He takes this classic area of Judea and the Galilee, and he expands to the other side of the Jordan, the what we call today the Golan, right? Take a look up here, Golanitis, okay? He expands over to here. He expands towards the coast, and that's, of course, going to be Caesarea. He even, and Ashkelon, and he even expands into an area that really it was very off limits to Jews because of the conflict between them. And that's the area of Samaria, right? Of the Samaritans. Let's just understand where that is clearly. Okay, that's over here, right? This area of Samaria, he adds to Shechem. He builds in Samaria itself, in Sebastia, as he renames it. Right? And that was an area that really was not considered friendly to Jews at all. And Herod is able to expand to there. So besides his building projects, he expands territorially as well. Now, who is Herod? That's the question that everybody always asks when you're learning about Herod. Jew, not a Jew. Right? Our favorite question. Was Herod a Jew? Was he not a Jew? And the answer is complicated because Herod is complicated. And in many ways, he is very modern in that sense. Let's go to the most classic understanding of Jews. Does he have Jewish parents? Right? So Josephus is our guide here. And if you take a look at the left side of the screen, right, there was a certain friend of Hyrcanus, an Idumean called Antipater. Antipater is Herod's father. Okay. He is an Edomite, an Idumean. Now, Josephus goes on and says, it's true that Nicholas of Damascus says that Antipater was of the stock of the principal Jews who came out of Babylon, but that assertion of his was to gratify Herod, who was his son. So really, bottom line, Herod might have spread stories that he's from a Jewish family, but he's not. He's from an Edomite family. An Edomite family that converts. We're going to see that story in a minute, but still not a Jewish family in their origins. What about his mother? Take a look at the second paragraph. Now, this Antipater married a wife of an eminent family among the Arabians, whose name was Kypros. Okay, so his mother is a Nabatean, a nomad, not Jewish. His father is a converted Jew. Converted in what manner? We'll see. Okay, so by our most classical halachic definition, Herod is not a Jew. Okay. Now, Chazal definitely followed that. And we have the famous Gemara in Bava Batra that's on the right side here. Herod was a slave in the house of the Hasmoneans. He set his eye upon a certain young girl from the house of the Hasmoneans. One day, that man Herod heard a divine voice that said, any slave who rebels will succeed. He rose and killed all his masters and spared that girl. Right. This is Miriam the Hashmonaite, who's one of Herod's 10 wives. According to this story, she commits suicide. According to Josephus, he has her tried for betrayal and has her killed. Either way, not a great story. And then, of course, Herod goes on and says, who expounds the verse, one from among your brothers you shall set as king upon you? Okay, that meaning he was appointed as king must come from a Jewish family. It is the sages insisting that a king must have Jewish roots. He then rose up and killed all the sages, but spared Bava ben Buta in order to take counsel with him. Now we're going to come back to this story next time when we talk about Jerusalem, we talk about Herod and the rabbis, but it seems clear from all our sources here that at least according to his families, he is not coming from Jewish roots. But ancient times, just like today, Judaism is more complicated, right? Herod ethnically identifies himself as a Judean. He wants to be king. He's never going to be Roman emperor, but he can be king of Judea if he identifies himself as a Judean, if he does good things for the Judeans. And we're going to see that he even does certain Jewish legal things, as we'll see in some of his palaces. Okay, so ethnically, he definitely sees himself as one of the people who live here in Judea. Culturally, who is he? Culturally, he's a Roman, right? Because the Romans are the culture that you want to follow. And that's why his cities look Roman and his houses, his palaces look Roman. So he's a complicated character. He is not black and white, right? And I don't think there's a simple answer to, is he a Jew, is he not a Jew? Unless you want to answer just black and white halacha. But how he views himself, much more complicated. Okay, so what is this whole story of Edomians? So the Edomians, the Edomites, right? People from Edom, from Esav, right? The brother of Jacob, living on the other side of the Jordan, of the Dead Sea. After the first temple is destroyed, the Edomites take the opportunity to invade to the western side, and they come into the area that's south of Judah, that was belonging to Judah in First Temple times, and they settle in this area. The place we're going to be focusing on is Mareshah, okay? But they also come to Hebron, they come to other places, okay? And they settle in here, and they're somewhat powerful, right? They're powerful. They are going to be kicked out, we're going to see, by Yochanan Hyrcanus, by this very powerful Hasmonean king. Now, who are these Edomites? They're complicated. They're interesting. They seem to be connected to this very mysterious people called the Nabataeans. And if you know anything about Petra, you know Petra, this incredible city in Jordan built out of carved out of the red rocks there, was built by the Nabataeans. We also know the Nabataeans had a spice route, but they're very mysterious people. Okay. They did not leave behind, as far as we know, anything written. Okay. They don't have texts. They don't have scriptures of any kind. What they left behind is their cities, okay, their route, the spice route that comes from the land of Israel going through Jordan and going down towards Saudi Arabia, okay, their cities in the land of Israel, their cities in Jordan, of course, Petra. But it seems that they have similar settlements, trade routes, and even gods to the ancient Edomians. And there are some that suggest that the Nabataeans are just the new name, right? The modern version of these Edomites. Herod seems to have connections to the Nabataeans, and we know he has Edomite heritage. When we will see next week, when we talk about Herodian and his grave, it has a lot of similarities to the monumental graves in Petra. So is Herod not only an Edomite, but a Nabataean? Maybe, right? And he seems to have that connection through his mother. Mareshah, or Beit Guvrin, as it's more commonly known. Right? This is today a beautiful national park in the southern part of the tribe of Judah. Right? In the time, the early Second Temple times, like we said, controlled by the Edomites. And they build up a lot. The rock there is very soft, so they were able to dig down and build deep cisterns underneath their houses. If you see this picture on the right, it's an amazing picture of a columbarium, right? A cave that was used to have doves nesting here, because doves, pigeons are very useful, nice little snack, right? You take one out and you eat it. They like to have a permanent nest, and so they would raise them there. And Mareshah was an Edomite city. Phoenicians were living there as well. Along comes Yochanan Hyrcanus, right? The son of Simon the Maccabee, right? Judah the Maccabee's nephew. He becomes a very, very powerful king, and he expands his kingdom south into Edomia, okay? And take a look at what Josephus said. Hyrcanus took also Dor and Mareshah, cities of Edomia, and subdued all the Edomians and permitted them to stay in that country if they would circumcise and make use of the laws of the Jews. Here comes Yochanan Hyrcanus, and he does something that is very unusual in Jewish history. Is it very unusual because of our values, or is it very unusual because we just didn't have the opportunity? Choose the answer you like better. But Yochanan Hyrcanus comes to the Edomites and he says to them, listen, you can stay. However, you need to become our allies, and you need to show the seriousness of your intents by circumcising yourselves and basically becoming Jewish. Is anyone coming around to the Edomite towns and checking people's tzitzis? No. Okay. But they are connecting to the Jewish people. Now, many, many Edomites have no interest in this. Okay. They follow a scorched earth policy. They destroy their homes. And that's why in Beit Guvrin, there's an amazing archaeological project going on called Dig for a Day, where you can dig out literally hundreds of Edomite homes that were collapsed into their basements, and we can learn all about their lives. One of the houses that somewhat survived, that's what you see over here, in the base of it, they found a coin of Yohanan Hyrcanus, meaning dating the destruction of this house to Yohanan Hyrcanus's invasion. So many of them choose to leave to destroy their homes, but there were some, like Antipater, Herod's father, who said, you know what, if you can't beat them, join them. And he does, right? And he becomes allied with Yohanan Hyrcanus, with the Judeans, with the Hasmonean family for a very long time. And Herod comes to power, just to fill in a little bit for a second, right? So we said we have this civil war between not Yohanan Hyrcanus, but Hyrcanus II. I know it's very confusing because they all have the same names, okay? Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. Antipater is pro-Hyrcanus. The Romans are also pro-Hyrcanus. So Antipater is a useful guy to have around. He is appointed the governor in Rome. He appoints his sons in turn to rule alongside him. Okay? And Herod proves himself very useful to the Romans. Now, there's a short period where you have a resurgence of the Hasmonean kingship after the Romans have come in. The last Hasmonean king, Matityahu Antigonus, he's supported by the Parthians, right? Guys on the other side of the Jordan here, sworn enemies to Rome. Romans want to get rid of them. Herod takes up the challenge, gets rid of Matityahu Antigonus, and is appointed king by the Romans. And from that point on, so basically, he is a puppet king, but he's a very, very powerful puppet king, much more powerful than any of the other governors, procurators who came along before him or after him. In order to cement his power, he marries into the Hasmonean family. He also has different allies. Like I said, we're going to talk about that next time. But he takes this leadership given him by Rome. The Romans don't care what he does as long as he pays his taxes and he keeps the peace. And he builds it into something much greater. Now, he builds many fortresses. Take a look at the fortresses for a second. Okay. A lot of his fortresses are built on the edge of the desert, what we call Sfar HaMidbar, the frontier. Okay, we have Masada that we're going to look at today. We have Herodian. We have Kypros and Hyrcania. Okay, and Phasaelis. All of this are protecting the eastern border from invasion. We also have on the other side Macarius. Okay. And of course, he builds his other cities as well, okay? But his fortresses are meant to be palaces / fortresses, meaning they are very, very beautiful and ornate. He lives in some of them. Don't ask me, everybody's favorite question is, how long does he live in each one? I have no idea. But presumably, it's based on seasons, right? He went out to Masada in the wintertime, right? He went to Jericho in the wintertime. He goes up north, or he goes to Caesarea in the summertime, depending on what's going on. But he creates this splendor, but also it's a fortress, right? And it's meant to protect Judea from invaders coming in from the east. Okay, so we are going to start with Masada. And I assume most people are familiar with Masada, have been to Masada. Masada is an amazing choice for a palace and a fortress. Okay, take a look at it. That's why this aerial picture is so fabulous. Okay, take a look at it, and you can see that it has two great advantages. Number one, it is not connected to the mountains around it. Right? See how it stands alone. And you can see this very clearly when you're driving down to Masada. It stands alone. It's cut off. So the only access at Herod's time, right? The Romans are going to change that. We're going to see. But in Herod's time, the only access is this, what's called the snake path, which you can understand very clearly by looking at it, why it's called the snake path, snaking up the mountain, which is still around today with a few modern modifications like guardrails. Herod didn't worry so much about that. Okay. And this can only be traversed by one person at a time. Nobody can attack that way. That's why when the Romans come along, long after Herod, they're going to build this siege ramp on the other side. Okay, so it's very hard to access the mountain. That's number one. So that's very good for protection and security. But the mountain itself is relatively flat. Now, when you go to Masada, you know, it's not really flat. You're schlepping up and down, but it's flat enough that you can build on top, that you have plenty of room to build whatever you want to do. Now, Herod's not the first person who discovers this mountain. There's already building here in the time of the Hasmoneans by Alexander Yanai, a generation and a half before Herod, but they don't do anything particularly impressive. Herod's the one who comes along and really builds and creates something incredible here. So just to remember where we are, I think most of us know where we are, right? We are about two-thirds of the way down the Dead Sea in the Judean desert. Okay, again, difficult to access today. Unfortunately, for the last 50, 60 years, the Dead Sea has been steadily shrinking. Huge environmental crisis, right? But in ancient times, the Dead Sea shrank or expanded depending on how much rain there was. And in the time of Herod, in Second Temple times, most of Second Temple times, the cliffs that are over here, right? The cliffs at the northern edge of the Dead Sea, the sea extended almost all the way to the cliffs. So that once you got to Qumran, we're going to talk about this in the Dead Sea Scrolls in a couple of weeks, you basically had to get on a boat if you wanted to go further south. There was no road to go further south unless you went inland and you climbed through the mountains there. So Masada is relatively cut off. Right, and that helps in order to make it more of a security, you know, a safety element. Okay, let's understand for a minute what Masada looks like. Right, the site map. Herod, why have one palace when you can have two? Right, and he builds a western palace, and he builds what we're going to focus on, the northern palace, which is really an architectural wonder. It's an incredible thing built into the side of the mountain here. Okay, each of the palaces, of course, has bathhouses. The western palace has a swimming pool. There are storehouses for all the food that he's going to need. Now, we are going to see that the story is going to take a turn, right? Because after Herod dies, a generation later, the zealots, the fighters against the Romans, are going to take over, and they are going to make some modifications, building a wall all around the edge, a casemate wall, right? Houses in the wall, building a synagogue, and the Romans are going to come along and build their ramp, right? So things are going to change. But Herod starts out with his two palaces, with the snake path gate, with great security and water and food supplies, all of which we are going to see in a moment. Okay, so we've got two palaces. The northern palace, like I said, built into the cliff, huge challenge. To do such a thing, one of Herod's great desires in life is power. Okay, Herod is definitely driven by wanting power, and power, certainly in ancient times, today as well, but certainly in ancient times, power also means power over nature. Can I overcome the obstacles that the topography and the climate have given to me? And he does that time after time. He does it in Masada. We're going to see it in Caesarea. He does it in Herodian. Okay, so there's a mountain. I want a palace dug into the mountain. And he goes to his architects and he tells them. One of the things we're going to see all along is that Herod, unlike a lot of rich people who can do whatever they want, Herod actually has really good taste. Right? He can do whatever he wants, but what he wants happens to be really beautiful, or else he had really good advisors, because pretty much everything he builds is stunning. And this palace is stunning. And if you've ever stood at the top here, and I'm sure a lot of you have, to see the view of the desert is spectacular. It's truly spectacular, backbreaking, difficult, but spectacular. The Western Palace, less fabulous, but also beautiful. Mosaics, swimming pools, all kinds of interesting discoveries that have been made there more recently. Assume that, you know, if you've ever watched any good British shows about country homes, right? That's what it's like here in Masada. Most of the year, there's a skeleton staff keeping things going. And then they get the message the king is coming with his entourage, lay in the supplies, fill the swimming pool, heat up the water, right? Get everything ready. So we can assume most of the year, Masada is probably not inhabited. Herod is not hanging out there in July and August like all the crazy tourists. Now, Herod, just take a look for a second. When you go to Masada, Masada was excavated in the late 50s and the early 60s. It's been excavated again, but the original excavations are from then. And in those days, the way you showed the difference between the original discovery and what was rebuilt, what was reconstructed, was this ugly black line. Okay, today we do it slightly differently, but this is what you did. Okay, and if you, wherever you go in the site, when you see that black line, you know that everything underneath it is original and everything above it is reconstructed. And there's quite a lot of original in Masada. Now, Herod likes everything to be incredibly beautiful, but when you first come into Masada, climbed up the snake path, or more likely you've taken the cable car, you walk in, and one of the first things you see is this rows upon rows of these really rather boring and ugly rectangular rooms, right? Which of course all had roofs. Everything had roofs in ancient world. Roofs don't last. They're usually made of wood or thatch, and they, and time and fire destroy them, but everything was roofed. What are these long, ugly rooms that have no decoration, no mosaics, no painting, no nothing? These are storerooms. Okay. Herod is a very good mother. He's very concerned that the palace is going to be besieged and there won't be enough food. So he lays in a ton of supplies in storeroom after storeroom after storeroom. Okay. All the basics, oil, grains, legumes, but not only basics. Archaeologists found here jars that showed that they had been imported from Italy. Okay, wine and fish sauce, garum, that was a very important if you were a foodie in ancient Rome. So Herod had his Italian wine, he had his Italian fish sauce, it was all imported. Now, Herod lays in so many supplies that after he dies, the storerooms, the storehouses are still pretty full. Now, here's the thing with the desert, right? As we like to say in New York, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. There is no humidity in the desert. We're going to see that in 2 weeks when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's very little water in the air. And therefore, when the zealots come along 70 years later, most of the food in the storehouses is still good. And they use it because it's been preserved. It's been fine. Okay, so we have food. Now, just a little side note about food. It wasn't discovered in the storehouses, but it's such a good story that I have to tell it. Okay, in the 60s, in the excavations, archaeologists discovered deep, deep down in the excavations, date pits, okay? Date pits that clearly were not eaten recently, but were eaten a very, very long time ago. And they were brought and they were put in storerooms for about 40 years, okay? And in 2005, a researcher named Elaine Soloway in a kibbutz in the Arava down near Eilat decided that perhaps, these seeds could be germinated. And they worked very, very hard. And some of the seeds were actually able to be germinated. And this is one of them. It's called Methuselah, right? It's got a great name, the oldest person in the Bible. Okay? And they managed to grow it. So this is a 2,000-year-old pit and a 10-year-old tree. Now, of course, what we wanted was that we would have dates, right? You want to taste, what did those original dates taste like? Date palms, like people, come in male and female varieties. Like people, only the females are really useful when push comes to shove, right? The male ones cannot produce fruit without a female. You need the female also. But that did not deter the researchers. And they went back and they found more ancient pits that were discovered in Qumran. They germinated them. They got a female one. And just recently, September, I think, they harvested the first dates, the first Masada dates. People said they tasted very good. So that's just a great story from Masada. Food is all very nice. You must have water. Masada has very, very few days where rain falls directly on it, but that's not the point. We are in the Judean desert. And there are flash floods because to the west of us are higher mountains where there is rain. And if you are smart enough, you can figure out where the water is going to flow from those mountains. Obviously, it's flowing to the lowest point, to the Dead Sea. If you can figure that out and build aqueducts and canals, you can collect that water. And Herod had smart enough people who were able to figure it out and who collected the water in canals. Okay, this is the, as you're going up to the site, and the canals are right below. Okay, and then you see huge cisterns on top of the mountain that either were collected from the canals or slaves schlepped up from different places, but you had plenty of water, enough water to have a bathhouse in the northern palace as well as a bathhouse in the western palace. And of course, this is a classical Roman thing that you're going to have bathhouses. Herod, as a good Roman, of course, is going to have bathhouses in his palaces. But the surprise in the bathhouse is that you also find mikvahs. You find mikvahs, unlike in some places like Herodian, where the mikvahs were clearly put in later by the zealots as a mikvah by what they turned to the synagogue. It's not part of the bathhouse at all. Here, the mikvah is an integral part of the bathhouse. And the question is, did Herod put this mikvah in, and why, right? Who's using it? And that's one of the very interesting things. We think about Herod as anti-religion. He kills off the sages. He's definitely not very friendly to the Chachamim. But that doesn't mean that he didn't incorporate certain elements of Judaism into his own household. And mikvah in Second Temple times, as we're going to see when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, super, super important. So he does integrate mikvah into his bathhouses. Now, Herod uses Masada. Herod, despite, and we're going to come back to him, don't worry, we haven't left him behind yet, but despite his paranoia, he dies of illness in his bed. He isn't killed by anybody. And 70 years later, 66 CE, the great revolt against the Romans begins. We're going to talk about that in our last time, right? But the zealots, the Jewish rebels, the Kanaim, are very aware of Herod's fortresses and what a great resource they are. Now, they're going to come to Herodian, and they come to Masada as well. They don't need all of the frills that Herod has. What they do need is they need a wall. They need protection. Okay? They need houses. They need to have a synagogue that we're going to see in a minute. And Masada becomes a refuge for zealots coming from all over the Judean desert. Right? They come from En Gedi. They come from Qumran. Masada, as we know, is the last stand. As these places fall one by one, they come to Masada. Yigael Yadin's excavations on Masada, which was an enormous national project, he's very taken by the story of the zealots, and so taken that when he discovers things like sandals or a comb and a hair braid, he built up a whole story about a zealot family. But we do know that, at least according to Josephus, there are almost 1,000 men, women, and children on Masada seeking refuge, right? Even after the temple falls, right? What you see here on the left is a fragment from the synagogue. We're going to see the synagogue in a minute. There was a geniza in the synagogue, right? There are scrolls that were put there that couldn't be used any further. Now, the temple and Jerusalem are conquered, right? The temple is destroyed, and yet the zealots still hold out in Masada, and the Romans do not leave them. The Romans do not say, oh, crazy Jews out in the desert, let them starve to death. No, they bring one of their most prominent generals, Flavius Silva. He comes with hundreds of troops. He comes with thousands of slaves, many of them Jewish prisoners of war. They set up 8 camps, army camps around the site. That's what these kind of baseball diamond things are. Why? Because the Romans believe very much that if you let one rebel site stand, it will be a domino effect, and everybody will, one after the other, revolt and gather strength from these rebels, and therefore not even one rebel group can be allowed to continue. However, they need to get from their camps to the top of the mountain. So they set their prisoners to work, right? And you can imagine the Jews on top of the mountain looking down at the Jews below, building this massive, massive siege ramp, which today is the easy way to climb up Masada if you have to come from the western side, so that they can send the classic Roman weapon of a battering ram up to pound the walls, okay, which they do. The siege continues until the year 73, 3 full years after Jerusalem is destroyed. But finally, the Romans break through. They breach the wall. It's late in the day. And the way Josephus describes it, Elazar ben Yair, the commander, gathers everyone, we assume in the synagogue, And this is one of the oldest synagogues that exists. And he gathers them together to decide what to do. Okay, now, the men, clearly, not the women. Okay, and he comes with them, and according to Josephus, and of course Josephus makes up the speech, but it doesn't mean, because that's what ancient historians did, but it doesn't mean that he didn't make a speech like this of some sort, right? And he says, since we long ago resolved not to be servants to the Romans or to any other than God himself, who alone is the true and just Lord of mankind, the time has now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice. We were the very first that revolted, and we are the last that fight against them. And I cannot but esteem it as a favor that God has granted us that it is still in our power to die bravely and in a state of freedom. It is very plain we shall be taken within a day's time. But it's still an eligible thing to die after a glorious manner together with our dearest friends. Elazar ben Yair basically says to them, here's what's going to happen. The Romans are going to conquer the site. They're going to murder us. They're going to violate our wives. They're going to take our children prisoner. We have no chance against them. And therefore, we need to not fight them, but commit suicide, right? And he goes through how they're going to do it. They're going to kill their families, and they're going to kill each other. They're going to draw lots and look at the last line. Let us spare nothing but our provisions, for they will be a testimonial when we are dead that we were not subdued for want of necessaries, but that according to our original resolution, we have preferred death before slavery. Now, in another part of the speech, he says, we are the last Jews. Now, that's a fascinating statement. They look out there, you know, over the wall, and they see thousands of Jews down at the bottom. No, we are the last Jews because we are the only ones who are not subservient to the Romans. And the Zealots believed that being subservient to the Romans was a form of idolatry. And that's why they needed to commit suicide, right? We know you can commit suicide if you're going to be forced to commit idolatry. And they seem to carry out this plan. Now, Yigael Yadin uncovered these ostraca, these pieces of pottery, okay? These pieces of clay, 10 of them with names on them, which he claimed were the lots, right? That these are the true, these are the lots, these are the stories. In recent years, there has been suggestions that maybe Josephus makes up the story, that maybe this is all just myth-making. It seems that there is quite a lot of evidence at the site to show that this story happened, including in the Geniza, we have a text that talks about suicide. Right? Josephus lives, he's a contemporary. If he made up the story of whole cloth, people would have challenged him. So I don't know if he didn't add pieces to make it better, but it definitely is a story that makes sense to have happened. Now, is it a story to emulate? That's a separate question. But Masada, in the early days of the state, in the early days of Zionism, Masada really enters Israeli myth. The Palmach takes hikes there, even though it's illegal in the time of the British. Right? It's kind of a testing, a proving ground. Yigael Yadin Dig is something that volunteers from all over the world come and join. In 1969, Yadin discovers bones on Masada, and they are given a full military burial, as you can see in the picture. Right? Today, Masada has, well, used to have, hopefully we'll have again, millions of tourists coming to visit. It is really one of the most popular sites in Israel. Besides the beautiful bird, Tristram starling, which you can see, these are Masada birds, right? Discovered by a naturalist named Henry Baker Tristram, and you see them on top of the mountain. But what I most love to see at Masada is if you go into the synagogue in a small little room off of the main room, there is a sofer, a scribe who comes every day, he's a Chabad Chassid, comes every day from Kiryat Gat to write a Sefer Torah. In the room where the Jews said, we are the last Jews, he is writing a Torah. And it just goes to show you that life is unpredictable, among other things, and Judaism continues. Let's go to Caesarea, because we still have a lot to see. Caesarea, very different site than Masada. Really the epitome of Herod's, showing how Herod built the economy. Right. And that's one of the things that's often overlooked. We're going to talk next time about Herod in Jewish historiography and in Zionist historiography and how he was vilified. But one of the things he really did well was bring in an awful lot of money to the treasury. Despite all his building, he brings in a lot of money, and Caesarea is a great example of that. But just before we get there, let's just see, because this is such a great aerial view. Okay, the main thing, of course, is the port. We're going to talk about how Herod makes the port. By the port, there's a whole private docking area with a temple on the top. Herod builds himself his own palace by the water. And of course, he adds all the accoutrements of a Roman city, right? A theater, a hippodrome, which then becomes an amphitheater, another amphitheater out in the fields over here, which you don't see. Okay, bathhouses, all sorts of things that Herod adds in that he builds literally from nothing. Okay, there is nothing here before. He builds it out of nothing. When you go to Caesarea and the visitor center, they have this a little bit kitschy movie that talks about how Caesarea is a city built out of Herod's imagination. And it is to a certain extent. Okay, so here we are on the coast between Netanya and Haifa, let's just say, right? A very good place for a port, but there was no port here at the time. And Herod comes along and builds this port. Now, we'll get to the timeline in a minute, but let's understand the port for a second and why it's so significant, okay? Herod creates a port out of nothing. There were, of course, natural ports. Dor to the north is a natural port. Akko is a natural port. Haifa is a natural port. Caesarea is not a natural port. It has to be creative. We'll see how he does that. But he does it because that is a great moneymaker. Anyone who comes into the port has to pay customs, has to pay taxes. They spend money. They pay coming in. They pay going out. And it's a way for him to build up the economy. So here's our timeline. Okay? It's a small city in the third century, but not a port in any way. It's captured by the Hasmoneans, but it only becomes something great with Herod, who, of course, loves to name things after his patron. So he names it Caesarea in honor of the Caesar Augustus. But after Herod, let's just understand it for a minute because it's important. Caesarea becomes the seat of the Roman governors, the Roman procurators. And we're going to see that in rabbinic literature, Caesarea is the Eretz Yisrael equivalent of Rome, right? It's Rome's seat in the land of Israel. The Great Revolt begins, sparked by an incident at a Caesarea synagogue. Okay? It's a mixed city, Jews and Gentiles, very Gentile presence here. In the Bar Kokhba revolt, Caesarea is the headquarters of the commander. Rabbi Akiva is executed in Caesarea. Okay, and yet the city bounces back in the Byzantine period. We have a strong Jewish community headed by Rabbi Abahu, one of the great Amoraim. We also have a strong Christian community headed by Eusebius, right? One of the great bishops. And you can clearly see in stories in the Gemara that Rabbi Abahu engages in polemics with the Christians of the city. In the 7th century, Caesarea falls to the Muslims. It loses its greatness. In the time of the Crusaders, it's rebuilt, but as a much smaller city. And finally, the Mamluks capture it, destroy it, as they do much of the coast. It stands empty till the late 19th century, when Baron Rothschild buys up most of it. And it really only is developed as an archaeological site in the last 30 years or so, right? And of course, developed as a city earlier than that in the 50s and the 60s. What does Herod do to create this port? Okay, so in order to have a port, you need to have a breakwater. You need to have something that blocks the waves so that the ships can come in and be safe. Normally, a port is in a natural bay, in a place that has a natural breakwater. Caesarea doesn't have that. Again, doesn't stop Herod. What does he do? And take a look at this great picture here on the left, somebody named Aryeh Bar. What he does is he makes wooden frames. He fills them with Roman cement mix, which is what? Volcanic ash, okay? And he has them towed out to the water and then sunk. And when the volcanic ash mixes with water, it solidifies and it becomes cement so that he gets this underwater wall that upon which he can then build his lighthouse, his port. But first he needs the foundations underwater. Today, the port is destroyed, but you can go deep sea diving here. You can go scuba diving and you can see remains of the wall that is here. And just again, and the other thing is to notice that when you come in, right, this is the VIP port. When you can come in all the way to the shore, what's the first thing you see when you get off? A huge temple to Jupiter, because Herod, like Herod in Jerusalem, act like the Jerusalemites, but in Caesarea, act like the Romans. And that's what you do. You're a sailor, you get off your ship, you're going to give thanks to the Roman gods. Now, Herod builds on an unbelievable scale, and yet he is one of the few rulers in history who leaves office with more money in the treasury than when he came in. Okay, how does he do that? He has taxes, he has tourism, he has a mint, right, where he makes the half shekel coins, but a lot of the money comes from this port. Port is just a fabulous moneymaker that is just was a gold mine for him. Okay. He builds this temple. He builds a lighthouse. Of course, everything named for various patrons. Okay. Drusus, the son of the emperor, the temple of Augustus is the emperor itself. The temple of Augustus is very interesting because after Herod's time, in Roman times, it stays a pagan temple. In Byzantine times, the same site becomes a huge octagonal church, okay? And in Muslim times, it's made into a mosque, right? Something that we see in the land of Israel all the time. Holy sites retain their holiness, even if the God that you are praying to is a different God. Today, this has been renovated. It's actually the new visitor center of Caesarea. It's fascinating. You can go underneath into the vaults underground. Ground, and it's a very cool place to go and see. Herod builds himself a palace here too. Not so much of the palace is left, but my favorite feature of it is he builds himself a swimming pool in the ocean. It's not a swimming pool of ocean water. It's a swimming pool of fresh water, because that's the kind of guy that Herod is, right? I want to have a swimming pool. I want to have that view of the sea, but I'm going to make it with fresh water, and it's going to be really beautiful. Now, his palace, when Herod dies, Caesarea becomes under Roman control, and it becomes the Roman governor's palace. And in fact, in the palace area, this was discovered, okay? Tiberium Pontius Pilatus Praefectus Judea. Okay, this is a very important site for Christians because Pontius Pilate, of course, was the governor in the time of Jesus. And he's mentioned in the New Testament. And he's the guy who orders the crucifixion, not a very popular guy in Christianity. But to find an inscription with his name, that's a big deal. Now, that tells you that Caesarea becomes the Rome of the land of Israel. And that's where you have this fabulous Gemara, right? Gemara and Megillah, Caesarea and Jerusalem. If someone tells you both have been destroyed, do not believe them. Both have been settled, do not believe them. Caesarea has been destroyed and Jerusalem settled. Jerusalem destroyed and Caesarea settled. Believe them. As it says, Amal'aha charevai will fill that which is destroyed. If one is full, the other is destroyed, and vice versa. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak proves it from this verse, right, from the verse referring to Jacob and Esau. One nation shall be stronger than the other. La'omi la'omi eumatz. This is the classic view of the rabbis, that Rome and Jerusalem are two sides of the value spectrum, and they cannot coexist. And unfortunately, throughout most of rabbinic times, at least, it was Rome that was on the up part of the scale and Jerusalem that was on the bottom part of the scale. But here we don't say Rome, we say Caesarea, because Caesarea is Rome in the land of Israel. Okay? And just to show us that, we have the ancient theater, which of course we have in other Roman-style cities like Beit She'an as well. Here, a lot of it has been rebuilt, right? If you build a city by the sea, a lot of it is going to be destroyed by waves. But we still have the understage, right? The dressing rooms are still intact. Some of the seats are still intact. The entrances, the vomitoria are still intact. In modern Israeli culture, if you play in Caesarea as a rock star, that's it. You've made it. It's like playing Madison Square Garden in America. It's a little bit smaller, 7,000 seats, but it's still a big deal, okay? Herod also builds a hippodrome. What's a hippodrome? For horse races. Okay, horse races, very long, narrow, very narrow oval. Because why do you come to the races? You come hoping that one carriage is going to knock over the other and there's going to be blood. It's a huge site that could seat 13,000 people in Roman times. Okay, later on, it's turned into an amphitheater, no longer a place for horse races, but a place for gladiator games. Right, but Herod first has this hippodrome, and he actually is very clever. We found tickets from that were sold here, right? Game tickets, admission tickets, and he also creates cycles, game cycles, four-year cycles, where there's not only a first prize, there's a second prize and a third prize, right? Everybody's a winner, makes more people want to participate. But the amphitheater has a very bitter end to it, a very bitter story to it. Long after Herod, in the time period of Bar Kokhba, the 130s of the Common Era, Rabbi Akiva, of course, is the spiritual leader of the Bar Kokhba revolt, and he is captured by the Romans, and he is taken, and he is executed, and it seems very logical that the place that he is executed is the amphitheater in Caesarea. It clearly was done in public, with people being forced to watch. His students are there with him. This is a Roman style of that everybody should see. Leman yiru v'yirau. Everyone should see what happens to traitors. But of course, this is the scene where we have the most famous martyrdom in Jewish history, what becomes the pattern for martyrdom forever after. And this is, of course, the story of the Gemara in Brachos. Rabbi Akiva says, with all thy soul, right? You should love God, Ahavta Hashem Elokecha, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart, u'b'chol nafshecha, with all your soul. Rabbi Akiva says, even if he takes your soul, afilu notel et nafshecha. That's how he explains it. Rabbi Akiva was taken out for execution. It was the hour of the recital of the Shema, and while they combed his flesh with iron combs, he was accepting upon himself the kingship of heaven. His disciples said to him, our teacher, even to this point, he said to them, all my days I have been troubled by this verse, with all your soul, even if he takes your soul. I said, when shall I have the opportunity of fulfilling this? Now that I have the opportunity, shall I not fulfill it? He prolonged the word echad until he expired while saying it. A bat kol went forth and proclaimed, happy are you, Akiva, that your soul has departed with the word echad. The ministering angel said before the Holy One, blessed be he, such this is Torah and this is its reward. He should have been from them that died by your hand, O Lord. He replied to them, their portion is in life. A bat kol went forth and proclaimed, happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, that you are destined for the life of the world to come. And this becomes the story of martyrdom that, unfortunately, throughout Jewish history, people have looked back to Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva is the first one who says Shema at this moment of martyrdom, which, of course, is followed by Jews in the Inquisition and in the Holocaust and in the many terrible chapters of Jewish history. They are taking the motto of Rabbi Akiva. Finally, let's come back to our city for a minute. Again, Herod needs to bring water. The Romans need to bring water, and they create an aqueduct system, bringing water from the springs to the north of the city. The aqueducts are largely still standing today, and they don't have the water flowing anymore, but you can still see them standing today, right? And the Byzantine city, sorry, I thought I had one more slide, but I don't. Hey, Byzantine city is also an important Jewish city, an important Christian city. Rabbi Abahu, one of the leaders of the city. But we are going to come back to Herod because we have many unanswered questions. Of course, we have to come to Jerusalem and see what he does there. But also, where does Herod fit into Jewish tradition, to the rabbis? What's the story there? So let's take a look at some of the questions that we have here. And then anybody else who wants to ask questions, please feel free. Okay, Unity and Diversity was my grade 12 text in Canada. Okay, I don't know if Shia Cohen stole it from the Canadians or vice versa. Why did Herod build the temple? I'm not answering that. We're going to talk about it next week. Tune in next week. Is Matityahu Antigonus a descendant of the Hashmonaim? Yes, he is the last Hashmonai king. I always get them confused, but I believe he is the brother of Aristobulus II. I can bring you the family tree. Melting pot versus quilt. Yes, very nice. Full size. Questions. Okay. At what point in history does a person become halachically Jewish based on the matrilineal line? Okay, I'm going to leave that for Rabbi Kelman, but if you do want to have a read a fascinating book, the same Shaya Cohen, who's an amazing scholar, he wrote a book where he uses Herod as a text case, and he calls it, what does he call it? Being Jewish, becoming Jewish, something like that, where he talks about identity, which was more fluid in Second Temple times than later. And identity could also be based on your practices, your ethnicity. But again, I'm not going into halacha. I'm going to leave that for Rabbi Kelman at the end. Petra is in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, Indiana Jones there also. Without the benefit of helicopters, how would they have found Masada as a great place to build on? You can see it. It's very clear, right? If you've ever gone down south, you see it. It's standing alone. It's clearly flat on the top. The ancients were a lot smarter than we are about topography. They really knew the land. They knew the lay of the land, literally. That wonderful story of suicide may be totally made up by Josephus. First of all, I would not call it a wonderful story. It's an awful story. And yes, scholars have been talking about this for the last 20, 30 years. And like I said, there is evidence to support Josephus. It doesn't mean that he didn't add to it. No ancient historian was what we would call completely objective. No modern historian is completely objective. But historians made stuff up. And they made up speeches, and that was a totally acceptable thing to say. Okay, Gamla, we're going to come to Gamla in the last lecture. It's good we have all these coming attractions. Were the Masada zealots extremists who were kicked out of Jerusalem? Masada zealots, well, first of all the zealots were extremists. And they are the survivors, right? They're the last ones who come after all the other places are basically destroyed. They're the ones who are the last holdouts who don't surrender. Are there bodies? Yes, that's what we saw, the military burial. There were definitely bodies that were found there, disputed whether they were Jewish bodies, Roman bodies. We don't really have proof. Certainly in the 60s, they didn't know how to test for anything like that. What language? No, the Josephus text is not in the Geniza. The Geniza texts are biblical texts. There's something from the book of Ezekiel. There's something from the book of Deuteronomy. I don't remember what else. But Hebrew, and I think there's also some Aramaic stuff as well. New evidence suggests that the zealots moved to the northern palace for the last fight. Okay, yes, it's not so new. Yigael Yadin, basically, when he found the sandals and the hair, he had a whole story that Elazar ben Yair lived in the northern palace and, you know, would be able to see the Roman camps from there. The siege ramp is against the western wall, right? I don't think there's something against the southern wall, but I don't know. Other questions. How did Herod heat the Masada bathhouses? Okay, Herod is following in the footsteps of the Romans. He doesn't have to invent anything, okay? The Romans already have a very, very smart way to heat their bathhouses. They have a furnace, and hot air is pumped in underneath the floor. And if you've ever seen a Roman style bathhouse, one that's nicely preserved, you can see that there are these little short pillars, right? And there are two layers of floor. And in between the two layers of floor, the hot air comes in, sauna, heats it up, nice, opens up your pores. Varieties of Jewishness, I don't think that's what it's called. It's downstairs. I don't remember the title. Is there one book about Herod that you recommend? I don't know. I will think about it. If I have one, I'll send to Rabbi Kelman. About how many zealots were there? So again, according to Josephus, and it seems to fit nicely with the archaeology, fewer than 1,000. Okay, Josephus actually gives us an exact number, 972. Okay. What besides you mentioning slaves and zealots, what else could Jews be after the temple destruction? Okay, so beginnings of Jewishness. Thank you, Ilana Lubin. That's the name of it. The aftermath of the destruction and where could Jews go and what could they be? That's the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a very important story. We will deal with it somewhat in the last lecture when we get to Gamla and Yodfat. What fuel was used to heat the hot air? Wood, right? What fuel? I mean, wood, straw, whatever they used in those days to heat things, whatever was lying around. They just lit fires, right? Does that answer your question? Other questions, other comments, Rabbi Kalman, if you want to talk about halacha, go for it.
Just before I do it, thank you for putting that on me. And thank you for your share. Thank you very much. I just want to announce this evening, our rotating Parsha Shear, Rabbi Natty Helfgott, will be teaching A Hole in the World, Creating a People from a Clan. That's this evening, 8:30, Rabbi Helfgott, Rabbi of Netivat HaShalom in Teaneck, New Jersey. Next week, the three new classes, in addition to our regular classes, on Monday morning, Sharon Lieberman Mintz will be giving a talk on the Sasson Collection, the Sasson Treasures of Judaica. She's an art historian, the curator. It's really should be a fascinating talk. That's just a one-time talk on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we're starting two new courses, Daniel Schwartz on anti-Semitism and modern anti-Semitism and the study of ancient Judaism. He spoke on Hanukkah, if you remember him, Dr. Schwartz, very well. And then starting on Tuesday evening, Rabbi Jeremy Weider, one of the Rosh Yeshivas of YU, who's probably the world's best Bal Kore, is all the laning online. He'll be giving a five-part series on understanding Tamei HaMikra. I think a very unique, I would say, series, and I think hopefully all the classes. So that's all the upcoming classes are regular classes. And the following week, we'll be starting another new class. You do have to register for each class. I don't know if anybody, I did get messages from a couple of people. They didn't get links. I'm not exactly sure. Obviously, a lot of people did get the link, but I'm not quite sure. You should get the link when you register. But if you don't register, you won't get a reminder email. So I don't know if some people felt before, but just a reminder, please do register for any class you'd like to get a reminder. We normally send them out an hour or two before each class. And they're also, when you register, you'll get the link how to log on. But it's good to have, because sometimes there are changes, things come up, who knows what. It's this way we communicate through email with people. So just to let you know. Now, before I maybe try, which I shouldn't try, to answer your question, I do want to mention on Josephus. So Rabbi Adam Mintz spoke back, I think before the summer, he gave a couple of series. One of the series was on history, and he has a whole talk on Josephus and history and biases. So if anybody's interested, like all our talks, we've had, I don't know, 1,500 talks. We had years of talks on audio before Zoom, before anybody heard of COVID. But since March, all our talks are not only by audio, they're on YouTube too. So you can watch the Adam Mintz talk on Josephus, if you'd like. You talked on Josephus as a whole, so that's interesting. I don't really have, and when was it halachically to be Jewish? The Gemara has debates about what the halachic, how you, it's not like, it was always a given that your Jewishness was defined by the mother. The Gemara in Kiddushin, if I recall correctly, and I may not, debates, different statuses of Jewish, but I totally agree with Shuli that it wasn't as, the halacha was not as developed. I will say what I don't really know the answer to that question. When would it become firm that it was probably, I'm assuming in the Tanaitic like period already, by the end of the Tanaim, I'm sure that was a firm halacha. But as you may recall, I recall as a young kid in tradition, in the 70s, tradition ran a series of halacha. Somebody wrote an article on suicide. I'd have to go back. And it was a whole back and forth in tradition. Was it halachically proper for the Jews to commit suicide? And I remember some of the arguments were, what do you mean what's halachically proper? There was no halacha. The halacha of suicide wasn't, that in itself was an argument. Was there such a concept? We know it was during the period of Hanukkah that the halacha was developed that you could fight on Shabbos. Pikuach nefesh is docha Shabbos was, I don't want to say invented, discovered by the Chashmonaim. Before that time period, there was an assumption you died, you couldn't fight on Shabbos. So a lot of things that we take for granted, this is, we need a course on development of halacha and halachic methodology and et cetera. But so you, surely you're 100% correct. It wasn't, what we say by the mother, and even today we know that there may be the concept of Zera Yisrael, which some people have said in Israel with the Russians, they may not be halachically Jewish, but there may be a status in between halachically Jewish and non-Jew. There may be a halachic status. That's a debate, but maybe your conversion standards are very different from a Russian Jew who, you know, thinks they're Jewish, was sort of brought up Jewish, their father's Jewish, very different from a non-Jew on the street. So these are complex issues. So I don't think I answered anything, but just to raise the issue. So, but thank you, Shuli, for raising the issue for the class.
Thank you so much, everyone.